I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
On this vote, the yeas are 216, the nays are 211. The motion is adopted.
For the first time ever, the House votes to impeach a cabinet member, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, over the Biden administration's handling of the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll speak with law professor Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez, author of Welcome the Wretched. Then to Gaza and the killing of a six-year-old girl and her family.
Officer, yes.
Yes, in the car. We're next to the tank.
And did you want to
see? Are you inside the car?
Hello?
Hello, hello.
Hello.
We'll look at the case of Hind Rajab. The six-year-old called for help after her family was shot and killed. 2 weeks later, their bodies were found alongside the two rescue workers who tried to save her. We'll speak with Palestine Red Crescent about the case. And what is the State Department doing about the killing, the arrests, and the attacks on Palestinian Americans, both in the occupied territories and here at home?
Nobody should be dragged out of their home in the middle of the night and beaten over social media reposts. We expect that the Israeli government will release my mother unconditionally so that she may return to the United States. This is our expectation because there's no other rational outcome.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. South Africa's urged the International Court of Justice to take action if Israel goes ahead with its planned ground invasion of Rafah, where over a million displaced Gazans have sought refuge. In a statement, the South African government said it's concerned Israel's actions in Rafah will, quote, result in further large-scale killing, harm and destruction, and breach the Genocide Convention. In January, the ICJ ordered Israel to take steps to prevent genocide in Gaza. On Tuesday, the UN's top humanitarian chief warned an assault on Rafah could, quote, lead to a slaughter in Gaza. In an interview with Reuters, International Criminal Court prosecutor Karim Khan spoke about the situation in Rafah.
Half the population of Gaza are concentrated around Rafah. The population reportedly six times its normal concentration. And when you have a population that is 60% children and women, by all accounts, the risks to civilians is profound, and I'm concerned. And I had to underline the fact that there's no blank check. There is an active investigation, and all people, all parties, are on notice. The Israel government is on notice. Officials, members of the military are on notice that we are investigating. If there are crimes, we'll get to the bottom of it. And we have our judges also here at the ICC to make sure that there's no room for impunity.
Meanwhile, Politico is reporting the Biden administration's not planning to punish Israel if it launches a military campaign in Rafah without ensuring civilian safety, despite public calls by President Biden to protect civilians. Displaced Palestinians in Rafah say there are no safe places for them to go.
We hope the war ends quickly. We're tired of fleeing from one city to another. We're so tired, I swear to God. People are tired. I'm hoping the world stands with us and looks at us with a kind, merciful eye. We're tired. We're always crying. Martyrs, shelling, destruction, death, starvation, thirst. There is no food.
While the United Nations is warning Gaza is on the brink of famine, Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, has admitted he's blocking a U.S.-funded shipment of flour into Gaza despite a promise that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu personally made to President Biden several weeks ago. Smotrich blocked the flour shipment after learning it would be distributed by the U.N. aid agency, UNRWA. In the city of Khan Yunis, the Israeli army has forced hundreds of patients, staff, and displaced Palestinians to evacuate Nasser Hospital, which has been under an Israeli siege for weeks. Israeli snipers killed at least three people at the hospital Tuesday. In other news from Gaza, an Israeli drone struck a pair of Al Jazeera journalists on Tuesday, seriously injuring correspondent Ismail Abu Ammar and his cameraman, Ahmad Matar, who were rushed to the European Gaza Hospital in Khan Yunis. Doctors had to amputate Abu Ammar's right leg. He's also suffered severe bleeding and still has pieces of shrapnel in his head and chest. The pair were critically injured while reporting on displaced Palestinians in the Rafah region. Al Jazeera accused Israel of deliberately targeting the journalists. According to Palestinian officials, at least 126 journalists have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. On Tuesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the killing of journalists in Gaza.
I'm deeply troubled by the number of journalists that have been killed in this conflict. Freedom of press is a fundamental condition for the people to be able to know what's really happening everywhere in the world.
The U.S. State Department has confirmed a 17-year-old Palestinian-American teenager with U.S. citizenship was shot dead Saturday in the town of Bidu in the occupied West Bank. According to the group Defense for Children International, Mohammed Ahmed Mohammed Qadour was shot in the head by Israeli forces while he was sitting in a car with a relative in a wooded area where local residents often pick mushrooms and sage. Mohammed was a senior in high school. Israeli forces and settlers have killed 98 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank since October 7th. Another U.S. citizen, 17-year-old Palestinian-American Taufik Hafez Taufik Ajak, was shot dead last month. In news from occupied East Jerusalem, Israeli forces have raided and demolished the home of Fakhri Abu Diab, a prominent community leader who's campaigned for years to fight the eviction of Palestinians living in the area of Silwan. Al Jazeera reports Israel has long sought to push out 130 Palestinian families to make room for a biblical theme park. In more news from the region, Al Jazeera is reporting the Palestinian human rights lawyer, Diala Ayash, has now spent nearly a month in jail without charge. She was detained January 17th at an Israeli checkpoint. Prior to her arrest, she'd helped form a new collective of women lawyers to work on the unprecedented number of Palestinians being jailed in the West Bank and Jerusalem following the October 7th Hamas attack. Tension remains high on the Israel-Lebanon border. Earlier today, one Israeli was killed and eight others injured in a rocket attack by Hezbollah. Israel responded by firing a barrage of rockets into southern Lebanon. On Tuesday, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah vowed attacks would continue until Israel ends its aggression in Gaza, he said.
We are fighting in southern Lebanon with our eyes on Gaza. When the aggression stops against Gaza and when the shooting stops in Gaza, we will stop the shooting in the south.
In Indonesia, Prabowo Subianto appears to have won today's election in a landslide. Initial results show Prabowo has received well over the needed 50% to avoid a runoff. Prabowo is a former general who's been implicated in mass killings in East Timor, Papua, and Aceh, as well as the kidnapping and torture of activists in Jakarta. Prabowo is a longtime U.S. protege and the former son-in-law of the former Indonesian dictator Suharto. Critics fear his rise to power could result in the return of military rule in Indonesia. Visit democracynow.org to watch our interview on Tuesday with journalist Alan Nairn in Jakarta on the Indonesian elections. House Republicans voted to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, making him the first sitting cabinet member ever to be impeached. The final vote, 214 to 213. Republicans accused Mayorkas of failing to uphold immigration laws at the U.S.-Mexico border. Following the vote, President Biden issued a statement saying, quote, history will not look kindly on House Republicans for their blatant act of unconstitutional partisanship that has targeted an honorable public servant in order to play petty political games, he said. Three Republicans voted against impeaching Mayorkas. Congressmember Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, who just announced he'll not seek re-election, warned the vote will, quote, set a dangerous new precedent that will be weaponized against future Republican administrations, unquote. The Democratic-controlled Senate is expected to reject the charges against Mayorkas, which would allow him to remain in office. In 1876, the House voted to impeach War Secretary William Belknap, who resigned just before the vote. Former New York Democratic Congressmember Tom Suozzi won a special election Tuesday to fill the open seat left by disgraced Republican Congressmember George Santos. Suozzi won nearly 54% of the vote, defeating Mazi Pilip, a Nassau County legislator who was born in Ethiopia, later served in the Israeli military. A pro-Palestine protester disrupted Suozzi's victory speech in Long Island. Tom Suozzi's win leaves the Republican Party with narrow 219 to 213 edge over Democrats in the House. In other congressional news, President Biden's urging Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson to allow for a House vote on the $95 billion foreign aid package approved by the Senate Tuesday. The bill provides $60 billion in military aid for Ukraine, $14 billion for Israel, and $5 billion for allies in the Pacific, including Taiwan. The bill also strips U.S. funding for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. The Senate approved the measure by a vote of 70 to 29, with 22 Republicans voting in favor. Three members of the Democratic caucus, Senators Bernie Sanders, Peter Welch, and Jeff Merkley, voted against it. The Senate vote came just hours after the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, urged the United States and other nations to stop providing arms to Israel.
How many times have you heard the most prominent leaders and foreign ministers around the world saying too many people are being killed? President Biden said this is too much on the top. It's not proportional. Well, if you believe that too many people are being killed, maybe you should provide less arms in order to prevent so many people being killed.
Meanwhile, President Biden's blasted Donald Trump for encouraging Russia to attack NATO allies who don't pay enough in military spending.
Can you imagine a former president of the United States saying that? The whole world heard it. The worst thing is he means it. No other president in our history has ever bowed down to a Russian dictator. But let me say this as clearly as I can. I never will. For God's sake, it's dumb, it's shameful, it's dangerous, it's un-American.
The UN has warned of escalating tensions in Senegal as the government intensifies its crackdown on protesters who've taken to the streets since last week denouncing President Macky Sall's postponement of February's election. Sall's government has again cut off mobile internet access and banned a large mobilization that had been planned for Tuesday. This comes as Amnesty International reported Senegalese security forces recently killed at least three protesters, including a 16-year-old teenager, in the capital, Dakar. Ethiopia's army killed at least 45 people last month as they carried out door-to-door home raids in what's been described as one of the worst recent acts of violence in the region of Amhara. That's according to Ethiopian human rights advocates who said government forces accused the civilians of supporting the armed group Fano. A pregnant woman was among those shot, according to witnesses. The extrajudicial killings in the town of Marawi come after months of violence between Fano and Ethiopia's military, which had jointly fought Tigray People's Liberation Front until until that conflict ended November 2022. Details of January's massacre only emerged in recent days due to a months-long internet blackout in most of Amhara. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission said the death toll could be higher. Authorities in Texas say the shooter who opened fire at a megachurch in Houston Sunday had legally bought an AR-15-style rifle in December, despite having a criminal record and a history of mental illness. Police identified the shooter as Genesee Van Moreno, who was shot dead by off-duty police officers working inside Christian pastor Joel Osteen's church. Two other people were injured, including the shooter's 7-year-old son, who was shot in the head by off-duty police. He remains in critical condition. In health news, The Washington Post is reporting the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is considering loosening its COVID isolation guidelines. The CDC currently recommends individuals who test positive to stay home from work and school for 5 days. Under the proposed guidelines, individuals would not need to isolate if they have mild symptoms and have been fever-free for 24 hours. California and Oregon have already moved away from specific isolation times. And in media news, the parent company of CBS Paramount Global has announced plans to lay off 800 workers, including 20 employees at CBS News. The announcement came just 2 days after the CBS broadcast of the Super Bowl became one of the most profitable and watched television events in history. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
For the first time ever, the House has voted to impeach a cabinet member. After failing on its first try last week, the Republican-led House voted Tuesday to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas over the Biden administration's handling of the U.S.-Mexico border.
On this vote, the yeas are 216, the nays are 211. The motion is adopted.
The House approved two articles of impeachment accusing Mayorkas of not enforcing U.S. immigration laws and making false statements to Congress. House Republicans have spent months investigating the secretary's actions as they gear up to make immigration a key election issue. They had to push the vote to take place Tuesday because they just won by a one-vote margin, and a new Democratic member of Congress could have been sworn in today. Former New York Democratic Congressmember Tom Suozzi won a special election Tuesday to fill the open seat left by disgraced Republican Congressmember George Santos. In a statement, President Biden called Tuesday's impeachment vote by House Republicans a, quote, blatant act of unconstitutional partisanship that targeted an honorable public servant in order to play petty political games, unquote. Meanwhile, the Senate passed a $95 billion military funding package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan Tuesday that stripped out a border deal that had been blasted by Trump, even though it was a Republican proposal and would have further militarized the border and ramped up immigration enforcement. For more, we go to New Mexico, where we're joined by Cesar Cuauhtemoc-Garcia Hernandez, a law professor and the Gregory Williams Chair in Civil Rights and Civil Liberties at Ohio State University. He's the author of the new book, Welcome the Wretched. His recent op-ed for The New York Times is headlined, "This immigration bill was never going to fix the border." He's joining us from Albuquerque. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor. Thank you so much for being with us. So you have the House voting for the first time ever to impeach the Homeland Security Secretary, the first time impeaching a cabinet member. And this was over Biden's immigration policy. And at the same time, you have the Republicans rejecting their own proposed border policy that further militarized the border because President Trump didn't like it. If you can talk about the significance of what's taking place right now, where the Democrats and Republicans stand on the border and what needs to be done.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Amy and Juan. Look, I wake up most mornings and I spend a good chunk of my day criticizing the Department of Homeland Security that Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas oversees. But the sad reality is that The politics of immigration policy have really taken over in Congress. There's nothing that Secretary Mayorkas is doing that is so out of line with what other top immigration officials have done under both Republican and Democratic administrations to merit the impeachment vote that we saw yesterday. You know, the reality is that the two parties in Congress are trying to out-tough one another in an endless repetition of policies that we've seen in the past. The immigration bill that was unveiled in the Senate just recently would have devoted more money to hiring more Border Patrol agents, more money to paying for more immigration detention beds across the network that the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency operates, and more money for advanced surveillance technologies. All the while, the political bargaining chip was asylum, closing off access to the United States for people who are literally fleeing for their lives and hoping that in the United States they might find safe harbor. So as we've seen versions of this this debate in the past, and the reality is that we have never been able to police our way out of people wanting to come to the United States. And had this bill gotten some traction in either the Senate or the House, and ended up on President Biden's desk, he seems pretty clear he would have signed it. But my expectation is that we would have been in much the same situation just a few years down the road.
And Cesar, what about some of the Republican arguments on this? One, that the president was they were very concerned about his they claim he was abusing his parole authority and paroling large numbers of people unnecessarily into the United States. Also, this whole issue of the proposed bill about closing the border if it goes over the entries between ports of entry go above 4,000 per day on average. What would closing the border mean? Are they talking about closing the border to just people coming over, or also to all of the traffic, the commercial traffic that crosses that border every single day?
The parole authority that Republicans in the House really rallied around as one of the reasons why they moved forward with this impeachment vote against Secretary Mayorkas is truly an astonishing reflection of a lack of historical understanding. You know, parole has been part of federal immigration law since the middle of the 20th century. It was first used on a large scale while Dwight Eisenhower was sitting in the Oval Office in the 1950s. It's been used by presidential administrations ever since then. And if they don't like the way that the Biden administration is using it now, fine. But it is a law that is enacted by Congress, and Congress can change that law if they so choose. But to claim that Secretary Mayorkas is overseeing a department that is violating or subverting immigration law by exercising a legal authority that is embedded in existing immigration law is truly saddening. But when it comes to President Biden's declaration that had he already received the power that this bill would give him and other presidents, he would have closed down the border. That's also a truly astonishing statement to make by any president, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. Because, of course, those of us who have lived and those of us who have spent time in border communities understand that the border is far more than just the site of chaos and crisis that we would imagine if all we do is listen to members of Congress or members of the White House team talk about the border. It's also families that straddle communities across both sides of the border. It's economic relationships, it's cultural ties that extend for generations. And to promise to shut down the border really doesn't give much weight to all of the meaning that goes to those people who make their lives and hope for their futures in these communities, whether we're talking about San Diego and the on the western tip, or Brownsville on the eastern tip. The power that this bill would have given would basically have targeted asylum seekers specifically. It would have exempted U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents, folks with green cards, but it would have shut off access to people reaching the United States specifically to request asylum, that is, to request legal safe harbor, despite the fact that there's a federal law on the books since 1980 that says anyone who's in the United States and is physically present and is afraid for their lives can request asylum. This bill would have empowered the Department of Homeland Security to really just turn them around. That's exactly what we saw under President Trump during his use of the Title 42 policy. And the Biden administration seems quite willing to return to that Trump era.
And I also wanted to ask you to what degree is all of this border chaos narrative affecting not just average white Americans, but also within the Black and Latino communities, as more and more migrants are being sent to the northern cities? There seems to be increasing tension, for instance, between Mexican and Central Americans, many of whom are undocumented but have been in this country for decades and are now seeing all of this attention focused on the latest migrants. What's your assessment of the potential for divisions, even within the Latino community, as well as other communities of color, as the failure of the federal government to deal with the current migrant surge accelerates?
It's impossible to ignore the fact that the first Latino to head the Department of Homeland Security is also the first sitting cabinet secretary in the history of the United States to be impeached. But on top of that, we're seeing that communities of color are really being vilified in this notion that these masses of people who are doing exactly what people have done for generations, that is, reach the United States, hopeful that in this land of opportunity, they might begin a new life, that in this country, they might reach the economic prosperity that is unavailable to them in the places that they are fleeing, and that in this country, they might provide their children with a secure and safe future that they cannot do in the homes that they are leaving behind. And in that sense, the folks who we're seeing coming to the United States these days from South America, from Central America, from various countries across Africa and the Caribbean are in no meaningful way different from the folks who came a century ago or more, and yet we're seeing in places like Denver and other cities that Democratic-led mayoral city governments are asking for their staff to cut essential services that are heavily used by communities of color that reside in those places. In Denver, for example, the mayor has announced that the local youth recreation centers will be cutting back their hours as a way of paying for support that the city is giving to migrants. Meanwhile, they're not taking advantage of the fact that there may be some other options available to them to support migrants without having to make those difficult trade-offs that essentially pit, you know, one community against another.
The Republican-led House had to vote yesterday, on Tuesday, on impeaching Mayorkas because they won by just one vote, 214 to 213. And a new Democratic member of Congress would have been sworn in today, and that would have meant that they wouldn't win. They'd already failed in the vote last week. The former New York Democratic Congressmember Tom Suozzi won that special election Tuesday to fill the open seat left by disgraced Republican Congressmember George Santos. Suozzi won nearly 54% of the vote, defeating Mazie Pilip, a Nassau County actor who was born in Ethiopia, served in the Israeli military, moved to Long Island. Swazi's victory leaves the Republican Party with a narrow edge over Democrats in the House. Many of the TV commercials that Pillip and Swazi ran during the campaign focused on immigration. This is a Long Island, Queens race. This is one of the winner Tom Swazi's ads.
The southern border is 2,000 miles away, but the migrant crisis has landed right in our own backyard. I'll work across the aisle to do what our leaders haven't: secure our border, close the routes used for illegal immigration, but open paths to citizenship for those willing to follow the rules, and pay a fee to help finance it all. In the past, I've worked with Republican Peter King on a compromise solution to the migrant problem. I'll work with anyone to get it done.
So that was Tom Swazi. Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez, if you can tell us more about, I mean, he really ran on immigration. It was the number one.